Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give and there's no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off and every now and then or once every time you listen. It's up to you. Click on the supporter link that you can find in the episode or show description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your payment.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey everybody, what's up? I'm Harry Romero, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hello everybody, and welcome to another episode of the House Culture Podcast, hosted by me, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're all missing that sense of community that the dance floor can bring us, so we at House Culture are absolutely delighted to be able to bring a little bit of the club directly into your world. If this is the first time you've tuned into the podcast, first of all, welcome. And second of all, please make sure you have a dig through our back catalogue of episodes, which feature interviews with the likes of Fatboy Slim, Danny Rampling, The Scum Frog, Ashley Beadle, Smoking Joe, and many more. Even if you don't recognise the name, I guarantee you they have a fascinating story to tell. And if you've only just stumbled across House Culture and want to get to know us a little better, as I always say, we are a collective of house music fans who have come together through our mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Instagram is where the party happens, and you can find us there at houseculturenet. Follow that and you'll get a daily dose of all things related to this scene we know and love. Let's get on with this next episode, shall we? In this one, we chat to the man behind one of the most enduring house records of all time, Danya, a man who is as comfortable behind the decks as he is the production desk, superstar DJ and head honcho of Bambossa Records, is Harry Romero. Now, we caught up with Harry as he had literally just stepped off a plane to play a gig in London back in February, so some of this chat is in a pre-lockdown context. However, we cover his whole career in music, including how a track produced by Todd Terry had a massive impact on him.
That's the bridge from hip-hop to house music is freestyle music. People like Todd Terry were sampling breaks from the freestyle records. You know, later find out he's sampling a lot of stuff from Chicago, and that's where Bango comes in. And when I heard Bango, I said, this changed my life, man.
Who inspired him in those early years?
Start 93. I'm going every Wednesday to Sound Factory Bar in New York to hear Louis Vega DJ. That was seminal in my career, man, because that... Again, that opened another box, if you will, in my brain.
What it took for him to become a great producer and DJ.
I caught the bug. I just literally came home and just spent hours in front of the sampler, and spending 3 hours and all the money you earned from your little job buying records, you just, it's your life.
And what his first experience of playing in the UK was like.
I was playing the Ministry of Sound in London. To hear about it and to be in the booth with the power of that system and the people in front of you was life-changing, man.
So get your passport ready as we're about to make our way over to New Jersey to hang out with possibly one of the coolest cats I've ever met. This is Harry Romero.
House Culture.
Hi, Harry.
Hello.
It's an absolute honour to have you on the House Culture podcast.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for fitting us into your busy schedule ahead of your London gig tonight.
Yes, looking forward to that.
Good. You're obviously famous all over the world as a DJ and producer. Mm. Someone who has stayed true to the original spirit and sound of house music. But we always want to start at the very beginning.
Okay.
Can you tell us about your experiences with music kind of growing up in New Jersey?
Well, music was a big part of my home. Being Latin American, there's always music playing in the house, always, constantly, nonstop. So there was always Colombian traditional music like cumbia, and always salsa and merengue playing. But what really kind of opened my brain to different styles of music was my father. My father, I always call him the original DJ. So at a young age, like, he worked all week. On Sundays, he would just listen to music. He had a stereo system at home. And he'd always ask, I'm one of three, so he'd ask my sister, my brother, and me to come listen. But they really didn't show any interest. I was the only one that sat there. And he would play everything Frank Sinatra. He'd play classical music. He'd play jazz. He'd play, you know, more Caribbean music, South American music. And he would explain to me, oh, this is so-and-so. This guy wrote this. And so it was a really good foundation for me musically, in terms of it wasn't just one style of music, it was everything.
Yeah, a real education.
A really, really super education. And then, you know, that kind of set the groundwork. But then what really, you know, as a more into pop music was hip-hop. At the time, we had DJs like Red Alert, and we had guys playing disco. I remember on KTU, Paco, he would play a lot of disco. And that's what we really listened to outside of what my father was playing, my brother and I. And that kind of, you know, when you kind of come into your own and you start discovering girls and this and that, that was the kind of music, and breakdancing was really big at the time too. So in that particular area where I grew up in New Jersey, in the tri-state area, what we call it, if you're a Latin kid, you were into hip hop. That's just the way it was. You know what I mean? Yeah. And we loved it. So we'd tape record the DJs on Saturday night, and Sunday we'd get the boombox and walk around and listen to, you know, the previous night's recordings.
Yeah.
And that's kind of really the foundation of my music.
And what was your, so if that was the foundation and kind of like hip hop and everything else that your father was listening to, what was your first exposure to house music?
My first exposure to house music, rewind a little bit. So after the hip hop thing in where we're from, there was a style of music called Latin hip hop, mm-hmm. which later they changed the name to freestyle music. So it was music based on like breakbeats with kind of keyboards on top, electro-ish, very electro-ish. Okay. And you had singers like Niobe, Cynthia, Coro, Johnny O, all kinds of, they were like strictly, mostly Puerto Rican, like singers, songwriters, this and that. So for us, it was like really, really cool because it was like our music, you know what I'm saying? As a Latin kid. And that was kind of the bridge, and I've said this before, that's the bridge from hip hop to house music is freestyle music. Because
yeah.
Then the likes of people like Todd Terry were sampling some of them breaks from the freestyle records, and then, you know, later find out he's sampling a lot of stuff from Chicago, and that's where Bango comes in. And when I heard Bango, I said, this fucking guy just changed my life, man. You know what I mean? And I tell him all the time, I'm like, Todd, you fucked me up, bro. Can I curse on this?
Of course you can. Oh. Yeah.
So I'm like, you ruined my life, and he laughs about it. Todd's a good buddy of mine, so.
How incredible is that you've actually like gone from him delivering that tune to your ears at a young age and yeah.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. But yeah, no, so rewind to Bango.
So I heard that, and it was like nothing I've ever heard in my life. It had the rough, you know, the tough hip-hop beats of New York.
Yeah.
And it had just some of the samples that were being used in freestyle music. It was astounding to me.
Yeah.
And it was like nothing I've heard. It was like, you know, when you open Pandora's box. So that opened Pandora's box for me. And, you know, as years went on, a year or two went on, I started realizing what he had done. He had taken a lot of the old Chicago stuff and just put it with a New York sensibility. So then I backtraced to Chicago, and I discovered a lot of the old Chicago records, like, you know, labels like, artists like Adonis and, you know, I don't know, you name them.
Oh, Kevin Saunders.
Yeah, all that stuff, man. So it was really cool. Yeah. It was really, really cool.
Yeah, I think that's a real thing, like a through line in dance music, no matter what era you're looking at. It's always that you hear something and then you actually understand that there's a sample there and you go back and you discover all this other stuff that is really good as well.
And I still do it to this day.
Yeah.
Like a lot of times I'll hear an old hip-hop record, I'm like, what sample was that? And now we have the internet, you just go, who sampled what, or who sampled who, and you figure everything out.
Yeah.
But it's really cool, man. It's a way, for those that care, because a lot of people don't care. For me, I'm like, yo, I got to know how the hell they, you know, what made them pick that particular section.
Yeah.
And then you, in doing so, you find other sections and you take it for yourself. Yeah. Do your thing.
And it goes just a rabbit hole.
Yeah, exactly.
On and on and on.
Yeah, for sure.
So, like, when you were talking about Todd Terry and making that tune, obviously he's pulling in all these influences and all of, like, a real melting pot and creating something new.
Yeah.
Was that a point for you where you were like, okay, I want to create something myself, or were you leaning towards being a DJ, or were you having clubbing experiences and just having fun at that?
So, I don't have that story, like, you know, a lot of guys are like, oh, you know, I was at the Paradise Garage when I was 12, and that's not my story.
Yeah.
You know, my story is very Jersey. You know, I started DJing in Jersey clubs. I didn't start going into New York to DJ till the early 90s. So, what was the question? My brain just went.
Yeah, so what was your sensibility first? Were you a DJ first?
Okay, so I was. So, there was a point to that, but I forgot. Anyway, we'll come back to that. So, I was definitely a DJ first, right? And then I said, I want to try and make this stuff. You know, a couple friends would buy keyboards here and there, samplers, and I'd hear them, you know, fiddling around with it. And I didn't really like what they were doing. I never said anything, but in my mind, I'm like, I could make it so much better than this. So then I would sample my own things, and my parents gave me money to buy my first keyboard sampler. God bless them. They're still with me, thank God. And I just started experimenting. So it went from DJing from like 87, 88, all the way until 92, 93 when I got my first keyboard. So, start 93, I'm going every Wednesday to Sound Factory Bar in New York to hear Masters, to hear Louis Vega DJ.
Yeah.
That was seminal in my career, man, because that, again, that opened another box, if you will, in my brain. Yeah. And I heard tracks like, you know, the New Eurekan So, the Nervous track, and just feeling the music. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, I caught the bug, and I remember at the time I was going to Rutgers University. Actually, probably not. I was probably going to community college first, and then I transferred to Rutgers. Anyway, I would come home, didn't fucking do my homework, I didn't do none of that. I just literally came home and just spent hours in front of the sampler and creating these grooves and just keep going until it's almost like riding a bike, until you just figure out how to balance yourself on a bike. And then you just keep moving forward and learning and going out and learning and going to the record store instead of class. And spending 3 hours and all the money you earned from your little job buying records, it's your life.
Yeah. It was your homework.
Yeah. That's why it took me 7 years to get my undergrad. That's a podcast for another day, though. So it became my life.
Mm.
It really, truly did.
So, obviously, you mentioned Louis Vega there. Were there any other influences you were kind of pointing in the direction of where you wanted to go with what you were doing?
It was Louis.
Yeah.
It was Louis. And, you know, if we use Louis, then there's Kenny, then there's Todd, that was it for me. I didn't look further, you know, as far as production, because I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just because they're from my, you know, we're from the general same area. Our sensibility to music was very similar. And I just love what they did.
Yeah.
Especially the drums. I'm a drum guy.
Yeah.
So what Kenny was doing on the SP-1200 and the early Akai MPCs was just astounding. It was unbelievable, man. And I kind of wanted to emulate that. And then I discovered Derek Carter. His sense of rhythm, I can't even describe it. I can't. It's just weird wobbly thing that just works in a real jazzy kind of patchy thing. And, you know, the early part of my production career, I was trying to create Derek Carter tracks. But in doing so, I created my own sound, which is funny in and of itself.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to look at things very humorously. So I've yet to figure out how to make a Derek Carter track, but I'm going to keep trying.
Yeah.
And by me trying, I'm just creating more music. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
How simple the inspiration is.
Yeah.
And I know I'm not never going to achieve what he's done because he's him. And, you know, we all have our internal metronome, if you will. We all have our beat grid. We all sense rhythm differently. But I just find it inspirational.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And what was, like, what was your first big break when you actually created something in your mind and you were like, wow, this is really something that I've done here that I need to get out there?
That's an interesting question because, I mean, I could cite the first two tracks I got signed, but yeah. Hearing back, I'm like, ugh, it's cringy.
Is that the sulfuric?
Yeah. It's those that came out on Strictly Rhythm and another one that came out, I think, on DJ Duke's label, Sex Mania or Power Music. He had this, that was both of his labels. I don't remember which it came out on.
Yeah.
But for me, I feel like if there's one of those tracks that kind of took me over the hump would have been either Tanya or Mongo Bonix.
That's
kind of when I feel like I arrived, if you will, in quotes. Yeah. You know, you can't see it, but I'm using air quotes. It's something that clicked, another box that opened, and, you know, there's no going back.
Yeah.
It's like your ears adjusted. My ears adjusted in a certain way. And I guess I spent so many hours in the producer's chair that it was inevitable. You know, I'm a slave to my craft. And I take that seriously. I take my craft very, very serious. And having fun is number one. But also taking myself out of my comfort zone. And that track took me out of my comfort zone. Why? Because there weren't a lot of tracks in the production, especially Tanya.
Yeah.
There was maybe 6 or 7. Prior to that, I had to have my console. I had a 32-channel console. Every fader had to be up. And in this particular track, it was a less is more thing, and it was a lesson that I learned. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just the simplicity of the track.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes restricting yourself or having restrictions, the best creativity.
100%. Especially when you're young.
Yeah.
Or when you're new to something, because sometimes, most of the times, it's possible to have too many possibilities.
Yeah.
And you just fucking go, you just go in a crazy different directions.
Totally.
So as long as you're aware of it, going in those directions, it could be a good thing. But as long as you're aware that you're going down a rabbit hole and you're cool with it, because along the way, you're going to learn something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this was one of those things where I was very conscious of the fact that I wanted to keep it minimal.
Yeah.
Exhausting the content. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And it's because it's so minimal, it's almost understated, but it has become like an almost classic standard. I can't believe like the longevity that track has had.
I think I made that track in 99.
Yeah, wow.
It does surprise me. You know, you don't think long term. You know what I mean? You don't think that you're going to be hearing the song, two decades later.
Yeah.
So it's great. It's definitely a blessing. And testament to my dedication and my work ethic.
So what are your memories of that when it first kind of came about? Like you said, you realized that you had arrived. Did you play it out yourself, or did you hear someone play it and saw the reaction?
The phone call I got from because at the time, my label was under Subliminal Records. And I remember I called. I'm like, hey, what are the pre-sales? And they're like, hold on 1 second. And they came back. They're like, you're not going to believe this. Pre-sales are over 10,000 units. I'm like, are you serious? Sure enough. And then the snowball effect, then the publishing deal came. And then the record just took off, man. Because at the time, I wanted to put that out with Mongo, with the guitar one.
Oh, Night of the Black.
I wanted to put that out as an EP with Night of the Black. So Tanya on one side, Night of the Black on the other. You're going to chop your income in half. I'm like, fair enough. So I split them apart.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was of 99, 2000. That's when I feel like I kind of arrived at the world stage, if you will.
And I mean, it's been remixed as well, kind of quite recently. Yeah. Honey Dijon and
Steve Lawler, Honey Dijon. Yeah.
Yeah. Who's kind of, before those remixes came about, was there a point where it went away and someone started playing it again, or has it always been like?
It's kind of just been just simmering in the underground. It's always just kind of there. Like, every few weeks or so, someone will send me a video, such and such played it, such and such played it. This guy played Night at the Black. It's always something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's the drums. It's the drums, I think.
I don't know, man. It's just the rhythm of it all.
Yeah,
it's just... Because you listen back to it now, it doesn't have the balls that my productions have now. But at the time, it was, you know, it sounded incredible.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Jose Nunez.
Yeah.
I mean, can you tell us about kind of how you first got kind of involved?
I actually met Jose Nunez through a mutual friend. Him and I hit it off on a personal level. And we started a record label called Gossip Records back in the day with some other guy that was partners with it. Long story short, we started a record label, and the record label was distributed by Strictly Rhythm. So he's like, I want to start a label. This was around 96, 97. Harry, I love what you do. Let's do a label. You know, at the time, I was a young kid. I was, what, 20, whatever? I'm like, fuck it, let's do it. You don't think, you know what I mean? It's just, oh, an opportunity. Every opportunity was you took everything you could. So the way the first three or four or five releases came about, it was just bomb after bomb after bomb after bomb. And the rise was quick. You know, we put out, what did we do? We did the Constipated Monkeys first, then the what's her face? It was a Jocelyn Brown record.
Oh, the Ministers of the Funk.
No, before that. It was, anyway, we could Google all this.
Yeah.
And it was just bomb after bomb after bomb after bomb. And the next thing you know, we're going on tour. And that's the first time I came to Europe. Yeah. In 97 was on the heels of what we were doing with Subliminal. And, you know, let's say, I think, I don't remember exactly where in 1997 the first release came out. But by October, I was playing the Ministry of Sound in London. Elephant and Castle. For those that don't know where it is. And we were doing shows in Germany and the whole tours. And I've been touring since.
I mean, was that kind of daunting? I suppose, you know, you say you're a young kid. And, yeah, I don't know what the reputation that the Ministry would have had, like, in the US.
We knew about it just through the... We knew about it through the trade pub, through the magazines.
Yeah.
To hear about it and to be in the booth with the power of that system and the people in front of you was life-changing, man. It really was.
Yeah.
And I remember, I don't know if it was the first or second time I played the Ministry, but I took the needle off the wrong record.
We've all been there.
And I remember going, zoop. I was like, shit. And they had a tape delay back then. So what did I do? I went, zoof, 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 and everyone went crazy. So I'm like, shit, what do I play now? So it delayed enough for me to figure out what to put on next, and the place went nuts. It was a great experience.
All meant to be.
Yeah.
And at that stage, were there, what were the major differences between a kind of UK crowd or a European crowd compared to kind of a US?
Well, here's the deal, is that prior to that, as far as me DJing in the States, I only DJed in New Jersey, a couple New York spots. But then, let's say 95, 96. The only other places I ever played were in Toronto and Los Angeles. And they were nothing like the Ministry of Sound. So it was like, it was very, it was eye-opening, it was scary, it was fun, it was amazing, it was everything just wrapped up into one, you know, funky package.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing Simon. I remember Simon would come when we would do it because we had a residency. Simon Dummer, I would see him always up top, just leaned over and watching and listening and like this every single time. Hey, wait, hey, Simon. Because at the time he was running AM, PM, so he was always there.
Yeah. What's your preference in terms of producing material? Do you prefer to sometimes work solo? Do you think like more well, better than one?
It depends.
Yeah.
I think if we're gonna keep it real, strategically it's good to collaborate with people. Now that's not the only reason why you do it, but that could be a motivator, and I'm just being honest. Ultimately what we wanna do is make great music. Whether it be by myself or whether it be, you know, going out of my comfort zone and working with someone that I admire and I respect, but has nothing to do with my sound or so I think. And kind of that rub is it creates really cool stuff. For example, like I was just in talks with Josh Wink, and him and I have been friends for a long time. And we've always said, we got to get in the studio, blah, blah, blah. So finally we're going to set up some studio time with me and Josh, which is incredible because he comes from although he does what I do and I do some acid stuff and techno stuff as well, But I'm curious to see what's going to happen when we bring those minds together and really see what happens. I'm excited about it, you know. So collaborations excite me for that reason, because you don't know what the fuck you're going to get. But I also love working alone. I love working in my, you know, in my slippers at home, in my pajamas. You know what I mean? Just home. I really love working in my studio because I know the sound. I know that what I'm hearing on my speakers is going to translate. Yeah, yeah. But I also like taking myself out of my comfort zone so I can learn as an artist. Yeah. Ultimately, that's what we want to do.
Yeah, just progress.
Just progress, yeah. You know.
Yeah. I mean, I love those moments. Like, for me, as just a fan of house music and, you know, club music and record crate digger and whatever, I'm seeing these collaborations come up. And, you know, the moment we see, like, your name and Josh Wink together on some vinyl.
But I believe that, you know, it's good to work, you know, remotely, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say if I do a collab with DJ, whatever, and he sends me stems, I send them back. That's cool, but there's nothing like being in the room. There's nothing like being in the room. You can't compare it.
Yeah. It's like with this podcast, you know, so many people are, oh, can we just do it over Skype?
It's not the same. Like, you don't have the, you're not sharing the same air.
No.
You know what I mean?
No, it's much better. I want to talk about vocalists.
Vocalists.
Yeah, I mean, you've worked with...
What are those?
No, legends like Robert Owens, a few times, Jocelyn Brown. I mean, when you're working with those guys, what's your kind of flow in the studio? Do you get those guys in, or do they send
you?
No,
we get them in. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So you said Robert Owens, right? So I had the track. So the track is called "I Go Back." Yeah. Well, it wasn't named at the time, but I knew it had Chicago written all over it. It had this, you know, the baseline sensibility of a Chicago record, of like a Larry Heard kind of thing. So I said, we got to get Robert Owens on this. So my management at the time reached out to him, and he flew in to my house. He flew into the States, and, you know, I picked him up at the airport. We grabbed something to eat. We go to the house. He heard the track already, but he's like, play the track for me. So he's got it playing, and he's like, I keep hearing this hook. I don't know. He's like, I don't know if you're going to like it. I'm like, let me hear it. And he's like, okay, I go back, way back, way back. I'm like, let's do it. That's literally how it happened.
Yeah.
I mean, we were maybe in the studio for 3 hours. Working for 3 hours. Then we just hung out and, you know, bugged the fuck out. But it's, you know, I love working with people that I trust. You know what I mean? It's like, you don't have to hold anybody's hand. You know, you do have to steer the ship sometimes because you're the producer. And what I like to do is be super efficient. I'm not the kind of producer that likes to have 32 unused tracks. That would drive me fucking bananas. I don't like to see it in my sight. Maybe because I have ADD or whatever, but it just drives me nuts. So it was real fluid and real concise how we did that session. And again, that record just took off. You know, Josh Wink is like, can I remix it? Masters I Wear, can I remix it? Everyone just wanted a remix. I'm like, fuck yeah, go for it, guys. Let's go.
Yeah.
And the record did real well. And I'll forever have my name associated with Robert Owens, which is the voice of house music.
Definitely.
Undeniable.
Undeniable, yeah. That voice.
And Jocelyn Brown is...
Oh, she's a diva.
It's fucking unbelievable, man. The power of that woman's voice is just... It's amazing, man.
Yeah.
And that... So, referring to the Ministers de la Funk record, so Jose had the sample of, it's called, a song called Que Tal America.
And I heard that the first time only a few months
ago. And you almost crashed.
Yeah. Like, it came in a restaurant, and I was like, what the, this is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I walked in the studio, and there's like, Jose's like, yo, check this out. I'm like, yo, that's dope. So I'm like, let me redo the drums, or the drums are whack. He's like, yeah, those are just fucking... Those are just whatever. They're you know, demo drums. I'm like, all right, cool. So I did the drums. And then I remember he got this guy called Benny Diggs, which at the time he was a big session guy. He was like a vocal arranger and a vocal producer. And he came in with, I think it was Lisa Fisher, Kim Mizell, and another. These are like super famous background girls. You know, Luther Vandross, the whole thing. We originally laid down the hook. You know, I did falsetto, and I think Dwayne Harden wrote on that record as well. And then we had the A-Team come in and do the vocals properly, and then Jocelyn came in. And if you hear her ad-lib in the track towards the last third of it, That's one take. And I remember we were behind the console. We were just like, holy fucking shit. We knew it was just, the Holy Spirit was all up in that place. And we just let her do her thing. And it was, you know, what you hear is that. Yeah. Yeah. We kind of really produced and arranged around her vocal performance. Yeah. We didn't do a lot of chopping of her. It's all live. Yeah.
Incredible power. Yeah. That track, still hearing that track out now. Yeah. It still does the difference.
And to hear from people, like, you know, you're on the road and you hear from people, they pull you to the side. They're like, you know, just to let you know, that record saved my life. I'm like, wow, the power of music.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, people that are on the ledge and, you know, they hear a lyric of something that you're a part of and, you know, keeps them breathing. There's a big responsibility in making music, if you think about it. There could be.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Yeah, I mean, people, it's because it soundtracks people's lives. It's so intrinsic to the moments that people hold dear. And there can be things that could be the most random track that means so much to people.
For sure. And it could be a love-hate thing, too. Like, I hate the fact that every time I hear this song, it reminds me of this. But you can't get rid of it. It's there. Yeah. You know.
It's not going to go away.
It's never going to go away. Like, a song like that for me is, you know, not to be Debbie Downer. I was a kid anyway. But when my grandmother passed away, there's a song by, the name's going to escape me, George Benson. There's a George Benson song that came out, and every time I hear that song, it reminds me when my grandma died. I'm like, great. So I'll always associate that song with when my grandmother passed away. Anyway, the power of music.
I mean, like you say, how are you when people come up to you and are like, oh, this track means so much to me? Are you kind of like, is it a bit weird?
I'm not good with compliments. I'm thankful, but I'm not, I don't know how to react. I'm like, hey, you're welcome. I don't know, what do you say? You know what I mean? How do you react? You know, it's always good to hear that your music has touched someone in a positive way. Not to sound cliche and corny, but it's the truth.
It's the truth.
Yeah, for sure.
You recently worked with Danny Tenaglia on his first solo material in over a decade.
I was so glad to be a part of that.
I mean, how was that? I mean, was it Don't Turn Your Back on...
Don't Turn Your Back on Hot Creations.
Yeah, I mean...
I've known of Danny since, you know, the dawn of my career.
Yeah.
He supported my music early on in my career. So I hold him in high regard. And he's become, the last couple of years, he's become a buddy. We text back and forth. We send silly memes. We send gross stuff, blah, 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 whatever. So for him to trust me to help him finish the track and get it to where he wanted it, where he heard it, was just amazing. Danny's like, would you mind? I'm like, Danny, come on, bro. Whatever you need, I got you, man. He's like, it's almost there. I just need that extra. I'm like, whatever the fuck you need. And he's like, you're going to remix this record. I'm like, if that's what you want, that's what's going to happen.
You just say no.
Yeah, I don't say no to Daddy. So I remixed it. And it's not easy to remix those kind of records, you know what I mean? Because you know the hype behind it. You know the fact that this is his first single in a long time. And you want to do you, but you want to respect the original. So, and Danny was cool. He's like, listen, I'm not signing this to them if you're not part of it. That says a lot about somebody, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know? He's his word.
He's a cool guy.
I did a party with him last summer, and they sent me the flyer. It was a rooftop party in Brooklyn. I'm like, my name was so small. I usually don't have a fucking problem with that. But Danny did. He's like, this is not going to happen like this. He's like, hang tight. Within a couple hours, they sent the flyer back, and my name was almost as big as his. I'm like, you didn't have to do that. He's like, yes, I did, Harry. This is bullshit, dude. You've been doing this for how long? Come on. I was like, okay. That says a lot about somebody's character. Those are the kind of people that I like to surround myself with. You know? No ego. You don't have an ego. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, before you kind of worked with him on that track, had you already got kind of a relationship with him? Or
just as, you know, hi, bye, hey, what's up? Yeah. Oh, thanks for this, thanks for that. But you know what I mean? It was friendly, but we never sat shoulder to shoulder in the studio. So it was a good experience. Yeah. And he just got a new place in Jersey. So him and I are going to be getting in the studio real soon. I'm excited about that.
Look forward to hearing that.
Because he has an ear like nobody, man.
Oh, man. Yeah,
you ever heard him play classics? He's my favorite selector. Him, Derek, you know, there's a few names up there, but he's inspiring.
Yeah.
I like when I go hear a DJ, I like to go hear them and leave early because I can't stand the amount of ideas I have in my head that I got to go home and work.
Yeah.
And he's one of those, him and Derek, consistently. I mean, I remember you talking about Danny. I saw the last Boiler Room he did in Miami. I think it was at the Electric Pickle. And I heard it live. And that night I made two tracks. It just fucks you up, man. He was like, damn, what is this shit, man? And it just stays with you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I love that shit.
I love that kind of journey as well, where it can be kind of, you know, the lightest of drums in like an old disco track from that era. And then like, you know, suddenly you find you in the darkest, like, tribal rhythms. Yeah. It's like, how did I get here?
Yeah. Another guy that does it like that for me is Robert Hood.
Mm.
When he does his floor plan. I mean, I don't know. He manages to just mix techno with disco. It's just unbelievable, man.
Yeah.
He doesn't get the credit he deserves, man.
Mm.
In my opinion. Mm. He's an inspiration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what would you say that your kind of style is, if you had to put a label on it?
I have no idea. Shit, bastard. You know? Bastard style. No father. It's a mix, man. You know, I mean, when I started going to record stores, it was house, techno, disco, hip-hop.
Yeah.
You know, it was those categories. Now you have a fucking 1,000 categories. I don't know what I fit in. I just do what I do, man. You know what I mean? I don't know.
I mean, what did kind of, for me, encapsulate completely your style and where you are at now, I suppose, was last year, in 2019, you did the Essential Mix.
Yes.
How did that kind of come around? What was getting the... I mean, it was about time, to be honest.
Yeah.
And, like, how did that call come through, and how did it make you feel? And
well, it was amazing. You know, my manager, Ralph Moore, he called me. He's like, yo, guess what? I'm like, what? He's like, you're doing the Essential Mix. I'm like, get the fuck out of here. He's like, yeah. It was that simple, you know? I don't know, I guess the timing was right, and it just worked out, and I was so glad to be asked.
Yeah.
And excited to do it.
And I mean, how did you kind of approach picking the tracks for that? Was it just...
Same as if I was going to go play.
Yeah, no way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you get a little more eclectic, because, you know, you have the space and room to do it. You're not stressing out, are they going to dance? No, because it's a different gallery, if you will. So you're able to flex a couple different muscles that you don't normally think. Like, I like the way I started it with the Jean-Luc Ponty.
I was going to say, it's the Jean-Luc Ponty track.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Which was cool.
Yeah. And some Chemical Brothers in there. And
yeah,
do you think it's good to be, like, eclectic in that way?
I don't know if it's good or bad. It's just me. You know? And I'm in London talking to you. So I guess it worked. You know what I mean?
Totally.
This kid from Jersey. It's always kind of been my thing, you know, because when we started DJing, you didn't just play one style or one tempo of music. You had to combine disco with hip-hop, with reggae, with house, with freestyle. That's the way it went. You had to keep people's attention.
Yeah.
And boonch, boonch, boonch. For 3 hours just wouldn't work back then.
No. I think having that kind of change of pace, the change of colour in the night, you know, with different rhythms and stuff, it's better than just hearing relentless.
That's why I like playing extended sets, which I don't do often, sadly. Because you get to, you know, you get to play different. You got more room to kind of spread out.
Yeah. How long are you playing for tonight?
Hour and a half. Okay. Hour and a half.
And what's your kind of perfect set?
Knock them in the fucking head. Beat them down. That's where it's going to be, an old-fashioned Harry beat down.
Incredible. And what's the kind of perfect, you say extended sets are good? Five hours
is great.
Yeah.
You get an hour in the front to just figure them out and play different cool stuff. It's fun. I like playing longer sets. It has to make sense, though.
Yeah.
Has to be the right crowd.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you're just going to beat them over the head for 5 hours. That's not fun. You know?
Yeah, no one wants that.
Yeah.
I remember reading a few years ago, kind of, you'd semi almost like lost faith a bit with the house music scene about the situation and the state that it was in terms of music.
Yeah, just the whole EDM thing just clouded my vision.
Yeah.
Fuck me up. I'm like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And are you kind of proud and re-energized about where we are currently?
Oh, with 100% sure, man. I mean, just the fact that I look forward to getting my kids to school as fast as possible so I can come back and work in the studio, because I have something to say. You know what I mean? It's like I have all these ideas and I want to get them out. It's that simple for me. You know, and then, like, I believe in finding the balance between making music and, while you're making music, figuring out what the home's going to be. So there are those moments when you just make music to make music for art's sake. Fuck all who cares what they think about it. It may never see the light of day, and that's fine, because that to me is like batting practice. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But then you have to be smart about what you're doing. Is it relevant? Has to be relevant. Is it going to be placed on a label that's going to, you know, have you move forward as an artist? So those are the things that I think about. But ultimately, what I'm excited about is that I'm on a creative surge, you know. And my approach is not that of a veteran. Although I am, technically speaking, that's never been my approach. I'm still that kid trying to get that idea out. I'm still that producer trying to make audible my first experience when I went to a nightclub and felt the music, the bass spins. That's kind of my MO, if you will. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
Did I just completely...
No. I mean, I always just nod, because sometimes I listen back and all you can hear me is going, yeah. What are you most excited about for the future? I mean, because, you know, there was a lull with the EDM thing, and now it's like, it feels like house music has found its funky bone again, if you will.
For sure.
Yeah. You know, do you think that's good for the future? What are you most excited about? Are you working on anything?
I think what I'm most excited about, for once in my career, I have a really solid team behind me. Before, it was just me going off and just fucking creating a lot of music. And just, in my mind, everything I made had to have a home. So now it seems like, although I am working less, I'm making less music, I'm also being smarter about what I'm making and strategic, where I've never had a strategy. And now, you know, 40-whatever years old, and I finally have a proper team behind me helping me, you know, steer and this and that, that's exciting for me. Because I know that it's not just on my shoulders. You know, I have people that I can bounce back and forth with and come up with the best solution. And most importantly, the creative juices are flowing, man. Without that, we don't got nothing, man.
Yeah. You know? Is it a scary thought that has there been ever a moment where you kind of sit?
No. Well, yes, but my approach has changed on that. Now I realize that it's, you know, I equate it to surfing. You're not going to catch every wave, man. But when you do catch that nice wave, it's going to take you. And then you get back, and then you paddle back out. You wait for the next one. So as before, I would panic. Where's the wave? Where's the wave? Where's the wave? There's no wave coming. That's it. I'm done. There's no more. I'm out of ideas. And then out of nowhere, you look out in the horizon, and here comes a wave. Yeah. So I know to trust that there will be a wave coming.
And who's out there at the moment that's kind of inspiring you?
I think someone that's kind of really inspired me is someone like Enmi. Mm-hmm. I like that deep stuff he does, man. It's really, really cool. There's not anything everything he makes I love. I don't play everything he makes because some of it's a little too sleepy for me. But I appreciate the production and his approach to it and his choice of sounds. Like that Rampa record, mm-hmm. The Terrace, that shit's unbelievable, man. He got away with using a real EDM sound. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he just created a masterpiece. That's a masterpiece to me. Yeah. Those kind of records inspire me, man. I can't say there's too many people now that I listen to. I'm like, oh my God, how did they do that? No, I mean, it's sadly, we kind of live in a culture where it's become very copy paste. So the ones that really put their heart and soul to it, you could hear. And Rampa's one of them, for sure. Yeah.
And me.
Yeah. No, not and me. I'm saying the artist and me.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Be clear on that.
Cool. Right. I mean, we're kind of getting to the point where we like to talk about the tracks for our playlist. You know, we always ask our guests to pick 5 tracks based on themes for our House Culture playlist on Spotify. We always ask for a catalyst. We've already talked about Todd Terry,
Bangor. Yeah.
I mean, as we go through each one of these 5, we just get a little background and kind of what the tracks mean to you. And when someone mentions that track or you hear it, where it takes you in your mind. Is there anything more to add for Todd Terry Bango?
It's just a good time. It's a good time, and you know, as a teenager, you know, you start discovering girls and the party and in the car, your buddy's playing the track in the car, you're going to the club, blah blah blah. It's just it reminds me of a good time in my life. You know what I mean? No fucking stress. You had like $5 in your pocket, buy a pack of smokes and a beer, and you're good for the night. You know what I mean? It's a good time in my life. You know. Yeah. And Todd did a lot of important stuff at that time, man. He was just, that's why I call him the God. And I tell him all the time, I give him props every single time I can, because without Todd Terry, I wouldn't be here sitting here talking to you, or Louis Vega, you know what I mean?
And speaking of a Louis, but not Louis Vega, Lil Louis,
Lil Louis, French Kiss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where does that take you when you hear that?
That takes me to a dance that my brother and I were DJing at this place called St. Pius. It was a Catholic high school. And you're familiar with the record?
Yeah.
You know when it breaks down and she starts moaning? So picture a gang of nuns running up to the DJ setup. It wasn't even a booth. And saying, you guys need to shut that off right now. Because, you know, I didn't realize that it broke down to a lady having a good time. So that record always reminds me of that, and I'll never forget it. And plus the record's just dope, man.
Oh man, yeah.
It sounds, you know, cliche, but it sounds like it was made today.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
When we spoke to Terry Farley, he talked about that as well, and he said that he played it in like Italy recently, and when it all breaks down and slows down, everyone's running over to the booth thinking that he was like slowing it down, and they thought he was doing this crazy
thing. I never let it get to that point. I don't play that part.
Yeah.
Because I think a whole group of nuns are going to run up at me. I think I'm scarred for life.
I've had an excruciating car journey with my parents with that coming on the radio.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That's like when my dad took me to see an officer and a gentleman when I was like 10 years old. I'm like, there's titties. What are you doing, Dad? I can't be seeing this stuff. He didn't know. He's like, I didn't know. Sorry. Well, enjoy the movie.
What's the sunsetter for you?
Cool in the Gang, Summer Madness.
Yeah,
that record just kind of it's just relaxed. It's like you smoked half a joint. It's just so relaxing. You know what I mean? You could almost picture the colors on the water. You know, and they're from Jersey, so I got to give Jersey props on that one. Cool in the Gang.
Cool in the Gang, and a tearjerker.
This song always gets me, and it's an odd one in the sense that, you know, big rough guy like me would listen to something like this. But Bonnie Raitt, it's called "I Can't Make You Love Me." That song is, she paints a picture, man. You know, and it's a tearjerker. It gets me every time. I gotta walk around with Kleenex.
And the last tune is "The End of the Night."
I gotta give it to Marshall Jefferson, man. You know, the house music anthem. Mm. I gotta give it to him.
Yeah.
It's just a good way to end the party.
I've certainly
ended on a high.
Yeah. I've been in nights recently where I've heard probably 3-4 different versions of that.
Really?
Yeah.
It's nothing like the original?
No.
Nothing like the OG. I mean, they did a good job with the remixes, but my ears are tuned to the original. You know, those 707 drums.
Yeah,
for sure.
And have you seen Marshall and kind of...
I see Marshall. Every time I go to ADE, I run into Marshall and we sit and we have a coffee or a drink or whatever. Mm-hmm. He's still at it, man.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, he's still at it.
Yeah.
Always good to run into him. He always has good stories. And I always have a slew of questions for him. I'm sure I annoy him, but... The only dumb question is the one you don't ask, so I'm going to keep asking. I love learning, man.
And especially
if you can hear it from the horse's mouth, dude. Come on, dude. It's like, you know, a lot of times we wait for these people to be gone, and I should have asked him such and such. You know, you know, so.
And our final question we always ask is, obviously we are house culture, and you are part of the house culture.
Right.
And what does kind of this scene mean to you, and what do you think it's given to your life?
Wow. I mean, I can honestly say that I've never worked a day in my life. You know, I did work before I started making music, but when I decided to make music my life, or when it would pick me, I don't know if I picked it or it picked me. Regardless, I've never worked a day in my life. The work is getting on planes and this and that, but the fact that I could provide for myself, my wife, my kids by making music, by doing something that I love and not having to punch in or be on the bus or a train and say, I got to go to fucking work for 8 hours. I can't stand this shit. When's it Friday? When's Friday coming? You know, that's such a blessing, man. And I think it's going to add years to my life, I hope, because I love what I do, man. You know, every day, yeah, it is daunting that sometimes you sit in front of a blank canvas, but you know that you have belief in yourself, belief in your skill set, and you know the wave is going to come and it's going to take you to where you need to go.
That is a perfect place to end, I think.
Yeah. Picture the wave and the water. I think that's wind. I don't know. Whatever.
Cool, man. No, it's perfect. It's absolutely great.
Amazing. Bang that on. Was fun. Good.
House culture.
How cool is Harry, right? What an absolute legend, a real pleasure to sit down with. I must thank him personally for finding the time to fit us in before his gig that evening back in February. Feels like a lifetime ago in a completely different world, but I hope some of you were reminded in that chat just how important this scene is to us all. Harry did mention Josh Wink in there, and you can pick up Josh's reinterpretation of one of Harry's latest tracks, Control, on Bambossa Records from all the usual outlets. Also hot off the press are a whole bunch of remixes of Harry's anthematic collaboration with Vice, Where Do We Go? Check those out if you can as well. And of course, Harry's essential mix is, yes, an essential listen, which you can find on SoundCloud. Comes highly recommended. And if you want to add some more sick beats to those recommendations, you can find all of the tracks that Harry picked for our Perfect Playlist on Spotify. Just open up your player, search for House Culture Perfect Playlist, and you'll be presented with a plethora of tunes that feature sounds from every corner of this thing we call house, all chosen by our podcast guests, past and present. Once you've followed the Perfect Playlist on Spotify, please support this podcast by loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, and by leaving us a rating or a review on Apple. This is really important and will help us to continue to create these episodes that we hope you love listening to. They could also get you a shout out on a future one as well. This time, the lucky shout out goes to Alex Hobbs, who got in touch on Instagram to tell us that he thinks the podcast is class. And he is 100% subscribed to us so that he doesn't miss out on any of the exciting guests we have coming up. There are quite a few, let me tell you. Any more comments can be made by hitting up our Instagram feed at HouseCultureNet or following the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. This way you'll be kept connected to other house music lovers from across the world. And finally, if you want to reach out to me, Matt Rouse, you can do it directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. See you next time.
House Culture.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.